Thank you very much. Kalimera. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'd like to join with the other speakers in saying what a pleasure and honour it is to be in this fabulous building. I'm also particularly grateful to the previous speaker, Siddharthan, for introducing you so elegantly to some of the brain concepts, because as you can see from this first slide, just if you thought you'd heard everything about the brain, you're going to hear some more. Not specifically, though, about the brain as Siddhartha was showing you, but more, I'd now like to go from that to explore with you the mind, and more specifically, how we might interpret some of the concepts of the mind from the ancient Greek tragedians, and see if they map onto, see if they can be realized in the sludgy physical brain that people like Siddhartha and I work with. I remember the first time I dissected a human brain, which is why I particularly like this picture, I did wonder if I hadn't been wearing surgical gloves, if I got a bit of brain tissue under my fingernail, would that be the bit that somebody loved with? Or would it be a habit? Or would it be a memory? And as you do that, if you are a neuroscientist or a neurologist, it does bring home to you this amazing miracle of how this very boring-looking object, as you can see that you can hold in one hand, somehow translates into all the things that make us so very special. And moreover, not only do we have these individual minds, no one has had a mind like yours for the 100,000 years human beings have stalked the planet. No one will again. But I'd like to suggest to you that at the moment, we're standing on the brink of a very special time when we might be undergoing unprecedented changes in the brain. So what I'd like to look at is the future of the brain, or if you like, the brain of the future, and explore whether we can learn anything about the brain, indeed the mind, from the ancient Greek tragedians. So let's start with Aeschylus. Now, I'm not a Greek scholar, but when I was at school, I did a little bit of ancient Greek. And what we were told was that the whole dominant feature of the plays of Aeschylus was that the dominant feature was not the individual, but the chorus. And if you like, the whole narrative, the whole story, wasn't about the struggle of an individual, but about fate, about determinism. So what could be the neuroscience equivalent of determinism? I'd like to suggest to you it could be the genes. And this is DNA, it doesn't look very special, it looks a bit like cotton wool. And it is indeed hard to think realistically whether this could account for all the very special and sophisticated and rarefied features that make you the person you are. Is there a gene for kindness? Is there a gene for humor? Is there a gene for short temper? I would suggest to you there is not. I don't think we can say it's just all in the genes, but let me show you an experiment that proved very elegantly that even when there is a strong case for arguing a dysfunction, a problem, is due to one bad gene, even then, the environment can make a huge impact. And this is an experiment now 10 years old that involved mice. And what the experimenters did was to tweak the genes of the mice so that they presented with the mouse equivalent of a disease called Huntington's chorea, chorea after the Greek for dance, because this is characterized in late middle age by patients presenting with wild, involuntary flinging of their limbs in a grotesque caricature of dancing. Now, you might think this is a pretty pointless experiment because these mice were clearly doomed to get the mouse equivalent. And the experiment I'm going to show you, the higher the score, which you're going to see on the vertical axis, the worse their movements were. So let's look and see what happened if one group of mice were different from their counterparts. If one group of mice were exposed to a so-called enriched environment. Now, enriched for a mouse doesn't mean to say they come to the Anassis Center and have stimulating 12-hour-a-day discussions with each other. If you're a mouse, your demands are much simpler. You're exposed to little wheels and ladders and so on. And in this remarkable study, they explored whether merely changing the environment in this way, producing a stimulating, exciting environment, at least as far as the mouse was concerned, would make a difference to this single gene disorder. And lo and behold, as you might imagine, the answer was that it did. Here you can see on the vertical scale, the score, as I've said, the higher the score, the worse the movement. On the horizontal scale, the age of the mice, they don't live very long, as you can see. Look first at the red group. These are always the controls that had not had their genes tampered with. And as you might imagine, they're doing just fine. They're not scoring anything. The standard housing animals, however, that did have the bad gene are living out their genetic destiny. As they are aging, their score is getting worse. But the amazing group, and the whole point of this, is that those counterparts who had identical genes and identical bad gene, because they're being exposed to this enriched environment, as you can see, the age of onset is much later and the degree of impairment is much more modest. So I don't think that we can say, even for a mouse, it's all in the genes, and certainly not for humans, there is no such thing as a one-to-one relationship between a single gene and a complex mental trait. So what is it then that makes us so special? What is it that gives us our minds? Well, let's think about Sophocles and his thoughts. Now, as far as I was taught, Sophocles did have the notion of the individual central to his narrative and dramas, but it was very much an individual at the mercy of the gods, driven by external forces, where, if you like, free will was not really featuring because you were manipulated by the gods, by external powers. So what can we say about free will? Well, this pioneering scientist shown here on the bottom left, Benjamin Libet, devised a deceptively simple experiment, and I myself have actually done this. I've actually been a subject in this experiment. All you have to do, that's not actually me, of course, but all you have to do is wear a sort of cap on your head that measures your brain waves, a so-called EEG device, electroencephalogram, and then all you have to do is watch on, as you can see here, a screen, and when you want to, just when you want to, you can press a dot. That's all you have to do. You just press a button whenever you want to. That's all the experiment is. But meanwhile, as you can see on the machine to the man's right, what's happening as you do this, your brainwaves are being recorded constantly. And what is really surprising is that prior to the will to move, prior to your subjective decision to press the button, guess what? Your brainwaves have already changed. And this is a rather spooky thought, because when I was filming this with the TV team once, they said, well, is it my brain or is it me? And I said, look, you are your brain. Don't you realize you are your brain? And that raises very interesting questions, indeed, about free will and about consciousness. Well, someone who was very interested in free will and types of consciousness was this man, Paul MacLean. He was particularly interested in mindless behavior because he lived at a time just after the Second World War when he was astonished and, in a lurid way, fascinated by the Nuremberg rallies. How could people behave collectively so monstrously? And his view was a rather primitive anatomy that people like Siddhartha and myself now would cringe to show, that the brain was divided into three parts, which he suggested reflected evolution, as you can see here, the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and then the primate brain. And moreover, he said this kind of layering, elaborated through evolution, reflected three kind of mindsets. First, the reptilian brain, and then one where in the mammals you actually could put your drives into a context, and then in the more sophisticated brain where those drives were interpreted in a more moral context. These, of course, are rather familiar and similar to the id, the ego, and the superego of Freud. Now, my own view is that this does not explain the monstrous behavior of the Nuremberg rallies. It's not that people have resorted to being reptiles again. Those people had a very clear storyline. They weren't in road rage. They weren't just losing their temper. They weren't wildly and violently lashing out. No, their violence, their hatred was directed very clearly against certain targets. It was adhering to a certain storyline. So I don't think we can explain, if you like, a loss of mind or loss of free will on this somewhat simplistic structuring of the brain. It is not such behavior. Mindless behavior is not an unbridled emotion, but it's a story. And if we're talking about stories and individuals, I'd like to now go to Euripides. And Euripides, more than any of the other playwrights, was one who internalized the forces that make us who we are, that actually explored us with an emphasis on the individual, with internal drives. So how do we explain that in neuroscience terms? Well, the wonderful thing about being born a human being, as opposed to, let's say, a goldfish, is that you have a great personality. I don't think anyone would claim that goldfish have great personalities, would they? And let's be honest, if your kids had a goldfish, and the goldfish died, you could go off and buy another goldfish, and when the children come home, they would know no different. You couldn't do that with pet cats or dogs, and you certainly couldn't do it, even if they might want you to, with their brothers or sisters. And this is because, even if you're a clone, that is to say an identical twin, you have a unique brain, and the reason it's unique, and again, this harkens again on this notion of pattern, is it's not due to the proliferation of brain cells, the blobby bits here, but rather the growth of the connections between them. And it is this connectivity that is unique to you that even a clone, an identical twin, won't have because, and this is the very exciting point, these connections are forged and framed and strengthened and perfected by experience. This is called plasticity from the Greek plastikos, to be molded. It doesn't mean, of course, that the brain is plastic. Here's an example of plasticity involving three groups of adult human volunteers, none of whom could play the piano. If you get the chance to do this, try and not be in the control group, because the controls just stared at a piano for 5 days. The second group, however, learnt five-finger piano exercises, but there was a third group, and these are by far the most interesting. What we're going to look at in our brain scans over 5 days with these three groups of subjects. Look first at the top panel, and as you can see, the people that just stared at a piano, nothing much happened. The brain was literally unimpressed by this. However, the middle group in the central panel, those who learnt the five-finger piano exercises, as you can see, there's an astonishing change in brain territory relating to the digits even over 5 days. But my surprise group for you, and the most fascinating group, were the third group on the lower panel, because these subjects merely imagined they were playing the piano. And as you can see, imagining you're doing something is pretty the same as actually doing it. So it is not the contraction of muscle that is critical, it is the thought that precedes it, and it's that thought that, as you can see, has a physical provenance in the brain. So these notions of mind versus brain, of mental versus physical, I think are very misleading. We don't understand it very well yet, but I think it's very exciting to explore. So let's think about the mind and how it's being changed by the environment, how it's working. Well, these are some pictures from my own lab, actually, and you can see how happy these rats, in this case, look like in an enriched cage. They are clambering and exploring. And if you compare one of their brain cells with a brain cell from animals that were less fortunate, that were kept in isolated conditions, perhaps you can see the difference. Siddhartha mentioned the dendrites, that's to say the branches that come out from the main part of the cell. And can you see if an animal, and imagine for us, therefore, what it must be like, is stimulated if the brain cell is made to work hard, if it's active, rather like muscles of your body grow and get strong, so a brain cell will grow more branches. And when it grows more branches, something very special happens. It can be a target, it can be a target for more inputs and connections. So you can see that the branches of a brain are a bit like a tree. The more connections you have, the more you can see one thing in terms of something else, the more significance, and therefore the more understanding from a unique perspective that you will have. You will see one thing in terms of something else. Someone mentioned this morning the idea of symbolisms and meaning. I would suggest that it's because you can see one thing in terms of something else. Out, out, brief candle is a metaphor in Shakespeare for dying, for example. Now, you can imagine the reverse happening, that if those connections were dismantled, if you could no longer see one thing in a personalized way in terms of something else, then perhaps you would start to become disorientated and confused, because you start off in a one-way street evaluating the world in just sensory terms, but gradually those raw senses, the visions and the sounds and the smells and the patterns, they suddenly, or slowly, not suddenly, so much slowly, if you like, become your mother or your friends or objects that you're familiar with. So instead of being a conglomeration of colors and shapes, they're a vase or they're a person or they're your mother. And the more they feature in life, the more connections they will be, the more meaningful it will be for you. If they are now dismantled, as happens in dementia, you can see what will happen. Here we have the embryo, the fetus, and the early postnatal cell, characterized by the growth of the branches, enabling you to see one thing in terms of something else, to go from sensory to cognitive. But if, sadly, as in dementia, these atrophy, these are dismantled, the connections, then you can no longer see the world in terms of other things, and you are back in the booming, buzzing confusion, back in a world of raw senses where things do not mean anything. They have no significance, and that means you can't understand them, so therefore you're confused. So I'd like to suggest the bind is the personalization of the brain through unique dynamic configurations of neuronal connections driven in turn by your unique experiences. And that's what makes you so special. Now, how does this relate back to Euripides? Well, do bear with me, and if I can have a few more moments, Chairman. I'd like to take you on an interesting journey. Let's start first by thinking of a loss of mind, for example, schizophrenia, where the person is very dominated by the outside world. They have a very fragile logic, and they feel that the outside world is invading them. Interestingly enough, schizophrenia is very similar to childhood in that both are easily distracted, they have short attention spans, they cannot see one thing in terms of something else, they can't interpret proverbs, and they have an underfunctioning part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is, as its name suggests, right at the front of the brain, which matures very late in life, in late teenage years, early 20s. We know also with schizophrenics, as you can see here, this area of the brain underfunctions. So what could they have in common, and what could this mean, and how could this relate in any way to, let's say, Euripides and understanding the mind? Well, I'd suggest that there is a notion where if you're eating a lot, some people who eat a lot are very greedy, the premium is put on the taste of the food rather than the consequences, inevitably, of getting fat. Now, such people are very reckless in gambling tasks. Interestingly enough, schizophrenics are also reckless in gambling tasks, as are children. And you can see this interesting picture of a series of paintings from a schizophrenic, starting top left with a cat that you could call cognitive, ending up bottom right with a cat that is clearly, purely a sensory abstract conglomeration. So could it be that an underfunctioning prefrontal cortex, which characterizes the child, the schizophrenic, the obese person, and compulsive gamblers, in all cases where this underfunctioning prefrontal cortex occurs, a common factor is a trumping of the sensory over the cognitive, a premium on the here and now over the future, or indeed the past or the abstract. So what might be happening in the brain? Well, let's think about being excited, being addicted, and being rewarded, all of which would occur if you were obese or if you were compulsive gambling, or indeed perhaps if you were a child, you'd be excited and happy about things. These processes have in common a chemical called dopamine, which is a chemical messenger in the brain. It happens to be the one lost in Parkinson's disease. It sits at the base of the brain and it acts like a fountain. And as well as working in the area that's lost in Parkinson's disease, it also targets the prefrontal cortex, this crucial frontal part of the brain, and shuts it down. It inhibits it. So what we can do is actually think of scenarios where people do have mindless behavior. This is Euripides' Bacchae, where you can see the King Pentheus being torn apart by the worshippers of Dionysus. Here's our modern-day equivalent, if you like, where people have blown their mind, they've lost their mind, they're out of their mind, they're having an ecstatic mind, ecstasis, to stand outside of yourself. You don't say, let's go out tonight and have a really cognitive time, do you? You say, let's go out and have a sensational time. Let yourself go, blow your mind. Lose your mind. And what I find fascinating is throughout history, human beings have abrogated the sense of self by tampering with the chemical messengers with drugs, or by putting themselves in an environment stripped of cognitive content, or perhaps doing something like downhill skiing where the environment is very fast. You cannot access your carefully crafted individual connections. So I think here we can have two basic modes of the human mind, and this is where I'd like to refer back to Euripides' Bacchae. In that play, as I'm sure many of you will know, Tiresias the prophet warns Pentheus of the two forces in man, the grain force and the wine force. And I think this does map onto neuroscience. We can think of the wine force as being strong feelings, whereas the bread force, thinking dominates. Sensory, if you like, versus cognitive. In the one, you're in the here and now. In here, you're in the past or the present or a future or a fantasy. Here, it's driven by the external environment, the pulse of the music. Here, the internal perceptions dominate. This has little meaning. What you see is what you get. The world is very literal. It doesn't mean anything other than what it is. Downhill skiing doesn't, it's not symbolic of anything. Downhill skiing is downhill skiing. Whereas when you have symbols, they mean something to you personally. Here you have a reduced sense of self. After all, you've let yourself go. Here you have a continuity of self going to the past or the future. Here's no time and space. Here's clear time-space reference. This is mainly infants and children, usually, with excess dopamine. This is older children, adults, with lower dopamine. Here, as we've seen, we can underactivate our prefrontal cortex, whereas here we have prefrontal activation. And I think that these two balances, these ideas, could correspond to the wine force and the bread force highlighted by Euripides. Of course, the answer is medenagen, udenagen, nothing in excess. We need a balance between these two to be happy and healthy. My fear, incidentally, is that the new computer world, the screen world, is imposing the world of the underactive prefrontal cortex, the excessive dopamine, the wine force, if you like, in an imbalanced way. This is a shameless plug for my book that says this all in a far less garbled fashion, but I'd like to end by paying tribute to the fundamental building blocks of thinking about what always this comes down to, thesis, antithesis, or if you like, men and dare. And in this way, I think early Greek thought, the Greek tragedians, in pointing that out, really did a great service to those of us who then were to try and explore these principles in the context of the sludge and the squalor of the physical brain. Thank you very much.